Ladies and gentlemen, program cards for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium.
Evening, Tomás. How are you?
Good evening, Raymond. Well, thank you. Another fine evening here tonight.
Yes.
The second instalment of the Britain 100. It's a fantastic. It's a really fantastic anniversary. And of course, with every week, we're seeing a few more layers of the Britain story come out.
Building the story, exactly. Yes, and focusing this evening on the time he spent in the United States, of course, and the influences he picked up there, and the people he met there.
Yes, nobody can get over the lovely pun of Britain on Britain, so Britain and America, spelt everywhere you want. And you know, in fact, the battle for Britain, that phrase, I mean, a big phrase now, a big popular phrase, that was used sort of 1947 was the first time somebody said,
really?
The Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
And this, of course, that was over whether or not he was to be taken seriously or not. And there's always this big problem, and that's really, again, we're at it tonight, you know.
Yes.
How seriously do we take Benjamin Britten?
Well, I think tonight we can see two examples of his work where he certainly should be taken seriously. That's the Serenade for Horn, tenor and orchestra is a wonderfully sonorous piece. It's written with, I think, a great understanding of what you can get from the voice of the horn, the voice of the tenor, and the voice of the orchestra. And that shows an astuteness and a development in him, which I think merits being taken seriously.
But see, again, the problem was people look at this and the detractors from in 46, now, they look and they say, it's a bit folksy, you know.
Okay.
The poems he selected for this are, you know, it's betraying his folksy, suburban, middle-class roots.
Do you think so?
Son of a dentist.
Yeah.
There he is. He's in a minor public school. He's learning piano out in the Norfolk Broads, not in the heart of London. And he's growing up in that kind of... in that slightly twee environment.
Yes.
And you've got this, he's not an artist who's suffering at all. He's an ordinary fellow.
Okay.
First job, he works in the GPO, admittedly the GPO film unit. He's doing that in the mid-30s, and he meets Auden. That's when we at least see the spark that maybe he's not a suburban artist.
Didn't he mention that he never met anybody more sensitive, a musical person more sensitive to the use of language in music than Britten? I think Auden was very impressed when he met Britten.
Oh, he was very impressed on every level. with young Benjamin Britten.
And just tell you, Tomás, was it as a result of knowing Auden that that Britten moved to America in 1939? Was it?
Yeah, in 1938. In fact, is when he went off. And yeah, I suppose the unspoken part of this tonight, we've got Bernstein, and we've got Copeland and Britten, but the fourth wheel here is Auden. I mean, that's the unspoken voice, the lure for Britten, and the whole point about tonight is Britten leaves Britten and heads off to New York, heads off to America in 1938. And of course, 1938 was a very troubling time to leave Britten. The clouds of war are over Europe, mainland Europe, and people were thinking very seriously that they're going to be dragged into a war, which, of course, we know they were.
Mm-hmm.
The defences, he didn't know he was, but a lot of people subsequently do look back at this period and think that was people leaving a ship in distress.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Tomás, we have in the programme tonight, we have a short piece by Bernstein, then we're moving on to Britten. The last piece that... Bernstein conducted in public performance, and I think it was the Tanglewood Festival in 1990, quite soon, shortly before he died, was Britten's Four Interludes. And this is probably the link here tonight.
And of course, the very straightforward, this is where Britten went to, New York, New York.
Of course. And we have the song, which I've already bored you about.
Well, I could not hear enough of your karaoke versions of Bernstein's songs.
You know that when they made it into a film, when they made On the Town into a film about 5 years later, they only retained three of the original songs. and the rest were all, it was all rewritten. You know
really?
That? Yeah, yeah. It seems strange to me that they would, but that's Hollywood, I suppose.
Of course, wasn't Copeland fully engaged with Hollywood?
Yeah, because, well, it's interesting now. I love the anorak facts, as
oh,
you know.
Me too.
Copeland's essential breakthrough came in 1939 at the beginning of the war when he wrote the score for Of Mice and Men, Steinbeck's novel. And Britain's launch to real stardom, I mean, he was well known within musical circles, came at the end of the war, 1945, with Peter Grimes. But of course, as we know, a lot happened in between.
It did, but I think we could definitely say that Britain and Copeland had good wars.
Yes, I think you could say that.
We could.
I think you could say that. But with regard to the Britain piece now, where we've just heard to most, the Serenade, I'm very fond of this piece. It talks, apparently he's dealing with, you know, nighttime, dreams, sleep. And I think it picks up very well. There's a slightly, dare I say it, sacred tone to the whole thing. Introduce, I love that sonorous introduction coming from the horn, and then the tenor takes over. But did you know as well that the horn plays the prologue and repeats it in the epilogue at the end? The only difference being that at the end of the performance, the horn is off stage. And I mentioned there earlier about it dealing with dreams. And I think when you hear it played like that and it's fading into the distance, it's like, you know, when you wake up and you've had a dream, mm-hmm. and you're trying to remember it, and you're chasing after it, and you can't quite grasp it. And I just think he's really captured that very well here, that sort of fleeting memory that's fading away into the distance, just as a dream. You say, I know I had a dream about something. Or, you know, you say, I had an awful dream, but I can't remember what it was. That is captured very well here, I think, in this piece.
And then, of course, you see, I look at it and I think, that's the sound of the fog of horn on the boat, because of course he wrote it on the way back
as they were coming home.
Yes, from New York. Oh, he's coming back, yeah, you see, in 43, yeah, yeah. And they've got the foghorn going, and he's very tense writing all this, and it's always, they were travelling in the dark, you know,
yes, yes.
Through the waters 4 days and nights, yeah. Filled with submarines,
very
U-boats
dangerous
all around it.
I mean, it was a fairly brave, if not foolhardy, move to come home in 1942 across at the height of the Battle of the Atlantic. But wasn't it homesickness that really drove him back to Britain?
We can put a couple of different things onto it. And I think that he had a very bad critical reception to his work. You know, there's push and pull forces in all of
okay,
these,
yeah,
in these
yeah.
actions. Because he's in self-exile. I mean, he's in self-exile. He's decided to come here. He doesn't yeah. have to stay away. The war has been on now for since 39, and this is 42. Things are moving apace,
yeah.
And he's decided to go home. But again, I think it's important for, you know, people thinking about Britain. It wasn't that he was getting a bad reception from the people.
In the States,
he wrote an operetta called Paul Bunyan,
yeah.
which was a huge commercial success.
But Tomás, hold on, let me draw you back there for a second. He read the poetry of George Crabbe, The Borough. And there was the character of Peter Grimes was in there, which he subsequently wrote the opera about. But apparently that gave him the most desperate longing for Suffolk, his home county of Suffolk, because that's where Crabbe had been from. And this was another force, which I think it was like a man caught in a line, a fish caught in a line at that stage.
If you look at the programme this evening, you've got Bernstein and Copeland. They're two sides of America. Copeland, again, he did meet Britain in London, and one of the things that always amazes me is that Copeland, who wasn't too, you know, wasn't much older than Britain, but he was much more famous, of course, and Britain, Benjamin Britten, persuaded Aaron Copeland to move, to switch his music publishers to Britain's music publishers, Boosey and Hawkes. Which, I mean, of course, had only it too was a relatively young organisation and had been two separate. You know, it had been Boosey and Hawkes, two separate publishers. They'd come together. Britain is with them. And then he persuades, he brings Copeland along.
You mentioned earlier about, Tomás, Britain's European. He was a man of Europe, and I think perhaps what there was a sympathy between Britain and Copland there, because Copland had studied, he really went through his musical formation in Paris in the 1920s. He moved there for three or four years. He studied with this famous lady, Nadia Boulanger, who had apparently a huge class of students and ran the place very rigorously. But for the rest of his life, he mentioned her in the most glowing terms, always referring to the fact that she was the key influence. He said something like, I remember, she knew everything from Bach to Stravinsky. And that was how impressive she was. And many years later, another what you might call national composer, if you can call it that sort of thing, Astor Piazzolla, from Argentina, studied with her, and he, of course, became perhaps the most famous composer of tango music. And also, if you think about it, at the time that Copland was in Paris, there was a fantastic milieu there of people like Hemingway, of Picasso, Chagall, Ezra Pound. It was an absolute melting pot of the intellectual cream of the Western world at that time.
Well, I suppose then he could take this advice from a young composer, because it cements his European credentials.
Yeah.
And that's really what happened, I think, to Britain. He went to New York. He experienced all that it had in its heyday. He had commercial success there. He wrote an operetta, Paul Bunyan, that was, you know, really commercially successful. It was lauded amongst the people of New York.
Yes, yeah.
But then, in the end, the critics got him. So the critics are very heavily criticising, as they should, I suppose, maybe, his work. He's writing, you can see, he's writing a lot of letters to his sister, Beth, and he's saying, you know, They don't like me here because I'm too successful with the people. I have too many shows. They don't like me because I'm English and nothing good comes from England. No good music comes from England.
Oh, yeah.
They don't like me because I'm not American. And I think that's it. He's not American. And he maybe came to America, you know, he knew Copland before, he knew the music. Auden says, come over, it's a brave new world. He goes over and he realises, I'm not an American. I'm a European. I'm an Englishman.
So looking forward now, Tomás, after the interval, we have the four C interludes from Peter Grimes. And one thing that Britain is highly regarded for is being able to form these interludes, being able to make, a virtue out of a necessity and write these four short pieces to move the action forward or to fill in the opera. And they often then get performed with some minor adjustments. They get performed as a concert piece in themselves.
Which is, again, part of the thesis, you see, because, of course, this is a poem. It's the Borough. It's Crabbe again. This is Englishness. As you said, this is real rural English. I think that's another part of this. Is that it's a tone poem, it's very modern, but it is about rural England. It's not London, and it's definitely not New York. It's another Britain. It's not the high life of the cultural milieu that Auden brought him to, with avant-garde poetry and avant-garde European sensibilities. It's very English, so he becomes English on the trip home, maybe.
Ladies and gentlemen, the door will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium.
Did I tell you earlier? It was in July just this year, as far as I know. No, it was June. And they did a performance of Peter Grimes on the beach at Albury in Suffolk. It was remarkable, apparently, because it had, if you think about it, there isn't much depth. It had to be wide rather than deep. And I believe they had to get all sorts of pre-arrangements made in terms of they had to record the score because the music, because getting the orchestra playing on the night wouldn't have carried at all. The singers recorded in advance as well, but also sang on the night to give it a little bit of authenticity. And just to further add authenticity, a Spitfire flew over just before the performance began. But I think people were there wrapped up because the great summer that we enjoyed in July and August hadn't come at that stage, and it was pretty bitter. I don't know if you know, out on the east coast of England there, there's a wind that can come from Siberia.
Oh, harsh.
And that was, I think, blowing that night. But I gather that despite all sorts of perhaps limitations and criticisms that could have been levelled at it, I gather that it was a very interesting and brave performance.
Well, it is, you see, this is the warmth of the English countryside that he wanted to get across. We immediately then snap and contrast that with rural America.
I always think of Bernstein as the big city, the bright lights, the skyscrapers, composer, that chutzpah and pizzazz of bright, brash, modern America. And Copland then is the voice of rural America, of the great plains and the prairies stretching as far as the eye can see, with the lonesome cowboy out there on his own beside his campfire, you know, pining for his loved one or whatever it might be. And one influence in encouraging him to write in that fashion was Dvorak, who, of course, wrote the Symphony from the New World. And Dvorak made great use of folk and ethnic music from his own central European base and heartland. And he also wrote a famous essay where he was saying, essentially, to North American, United States composers, that they had a rich resource there in black music, in Native American music, and so forth, that they, at that time, I think, were perhaps trying to write in a strictly Western classical character, and that they were, he said, well, look, you're ignoring this. Why don't you let this influence you? And that's what happens here. And you see it most obviously in the Shaker tune, which we all know, The Lord of the Dance.
And of course, there's another story, a subtext to this evening, and that's the left wing subtext, which is hugely important to all of the participants here, particularly to Aaron Copland, mm-hmm. particularly to Benjamin Britten. They're both left wing in a very interesting sense, and very left-wing at a very, very, very particular time. In this period in the 30s, they're left and they're hard left, and that does inform all of their works as well. And when you're talking about folk tunes and the Shaker tune, Shakers in the US perspective, they are living this stripped-down, lean, common wheel of
back
a life.
Back to basics.
Yes, but they're sharing everything, and there's a certain egalitarian equality to their lifestyle that made them outsiders in America. And that was something that was picked up by Copland, maybe even fascinated by him.
Informed his music, you think?
I think it informed his music. It certainly informed his philosophy. And Britten sees that. That spark is there as well. When you're looking at Peter Grimes, when you're looking at anything by him, at this point and from this point onwards, you're looking at him talking about the folk element, the amateur performance. All of these things are coming in. And that's really about the people, the proletariat, dare I say.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this was really too surprising when you consider the school, even public school, as they would call it in England.
The Greshams, I think it was, wasn't
it? That's it. And his socialist ideals were certainly imprinted on him then. And the school was rife with it. Contemporaries at Greshams included the founder of CND, Roger Simon, and mm-hmm. it included a Soviet spy, Donald Maclean, and indeed a fellow called James Klugman, who ended up writing the history of the English Communist Party.
Well, that's an interesting character cast, what?
They were all interested in the common man. They were all interested in the idea of a socialist utopia.
Yeah, but that leads me straight back to Moss. The phrase you even use, perhaps unwittingly, the common man, if you think about it, Copland's perhaps most famous work, Fanfare for the Common Man, written in 1942, associated with the Olympic Games, and played last year in just as the final shuttle mission landed. Not only do we know it as a very popular piece of music, it was taken up by all sorts of rock gentry, shall we say. The Rolling Stones did a version of it, Emerson, Lake and Palmer did a version of it. Copland lived long enough to hear them all. He lived until 1990. He was born in 1900. He was as old as the century. He lived to hear them all. He listened, as he said himself, with interest, and concluded that I prefer my own original version.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. All doors are now closing. Thank you.